Hello. This is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, with me, Michael Kuehl.
And me, Roger Bell West.
And this month, as spring sort of starts to get into the run-up of sprunging...
Well, I've been walking outside today.
You masochist, you. We will be talking about magic and getting deep into the weeds of stuff. This may get abstruse, and it may get metaphysical, and it will be long-winded, but that's just us.
What do we really mean by magic, anyway?
I know what I mean, but I don't know what you mean, and I don't know what him over there means, either. But first... We still receive from the nice people at Bundle of Holding advanced briefing of what they're going to be putting up. And when we think there's something interesting, we mention it to you. Sometimes to recommend and sometimes to just comment. At the moment, they're doing a lot of stuff which is wild and woolly and mostly old school revival. Focused.
And as regular listeners will be aware, old school revival dungeon bashing in general is not really our thing.
Not a priority thing. I like a good dungeon from time to time, but I think that the mental burden of getting my mind around whatever D&D is like in the mind of the author is seldom going to. Be rewarding. However,
not Roger to mention the whole ethical thing, you know, do you want to support a company that does that for various values of that, which we don't need to go into?
Surely they cannot all be moral monsters. He said with innocent naivety that he doesn't know how he's maintained unto this day. However, Roger has a thing he wants to talk about, which is, and I think I can say this safely, Vikings and Valkyries in space!
Yeah. This is the Shield Maidens RPG from Mongoose, and it's frankly a bit unexpected, and in a Bundle of Holding season when we've got lots of dungeons and old school revival and stuff, that in itself gets my attention. But there's more to this than it appears, because what it looks like is cyberpunk Vikings in space. Well, sometimes in space. But this is also a game that will really annoy that fascist in your group that nobody wants to mention. So, yeah, it's a good thing in itself.
I don't think I've got a fascist in my group.
I've known several groups that did, and everybody, he's off on one again. Just ignore him a moment, wait, maybe he'll stop. Anyway.
I have a dyed-in-wool story. And that's a bit of a strain, but I don't think I have any actual observable fascists. Maybe it's me.
So it is an arbitrarily distant future. I mean, it's not connected to Earth particularly, no. Though presumably the mythology has descended. There are actual gods, Norse gods, probably. They certainly give powers. It's an extremely high tech. And magic to the point where one, if you said this magic is just technology that is a bit beyond our understanding, you wouldn't be entirely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Our heroes are Shield Maidens, who are the resistance against the Empire.
Right, and the Empire is?
It's the Fenrir Empire. But rather than just your classic, you know, crushing everybody under your stylish leather boot,
hang on, was that the great wolf that comes to bring the end of the world type empire?
Yes.
All right, just checking.
Indeed, one of the reasons why there hasn't been a summer for 500 years may well be related to this empire. Basically, the cycle of being has stalled, and it is hoped that in some way overthrowing this empire will restart it. That's one of the things you're. That's it's kind of long term goal.
Yeah, fair enough.
But, you know, there is no messing about it. This is blatantly a terrorist group. I mean, they think they're the good guys. Terrorists always think they're the good guys. They may well be the good guys. But they're not, you know, doing cuddly bunny things all the time. There are plenty of bad guys to fight, so, you know, they're doing a lot of that. But, yeah. This is also a very feminist game. There is some background detail that basically, because of the nature of the people high up in the Empire, the plague that they generated to cause magic blindness, i.e. people just don't understand that magic exists, doesn't work as well on women.
Oh boy.
Because it was easier to sex link it and then make it more effective on men, which was what they cared about.
Okay.
So, it's a bit Magical Girl, it's a bit Star Wars.
It's a bit lesbian sisters against the patriarchy.
Yep. I mean, I've skimmed it so far, I haven't noticed specific mention of lesbianism, but it would certainly be absolutely not against the rules.
There is a wave of lesbian themed stuff going through. I just made an assumption. I should apologise.
I mean, it would certainly be in scope, but I don't think it's specifically part of the Shield Maiden's job. What is part of their job is to build their own shield, which is a technomagic artifact, which is also their character sheet.
Oh.
Basically, the components you slot into your shield and then the way in which you arrange them also is basically how you get your funky special powers, as well as your core stats and things.
Hmm. Okay, that sounds sort of interesting as a bit of game mechanic. And it may apply to some of the things we're going to be saying later. But
in terms of the basic stats, you split some points between mind, body and spirit. Then each of those has two branch skills, and each of those has three sub-skills. So basically you get 12 distinct areas of stuff you're good at, or not.
Yeah.
So at that point, it's about as complicated as Doctor Who Adventures in Time and Space. Not a complicated system, one we've talked about occasionally. And then rolling stuff tends to be 2d6 plus that. You can also get runes, which will have specific weird special powers. You can get Galdr chips.
Say that word again.
Galdr. Everybody, of course, who has the good taste to listen to IRTD will be aware that this is a form of shamanic song, not entirely unrelated to yoiking in Finland.
Thank you. I'm so much more enlightened now.
I mean, on first thought, I thought, okay, you know, they're doing Star Wars and they've pasted Vikings on, so at least they've pasted a coherent mythology. But no, they've actually done their research. There is actual, genuine Norse lore in here that is at least moderately obscure. There's a certain amount of fun. I am quite tempted to run it, not maybe as a long-term thing, but I think there's fun to be had here, which is why I wanted to mention it.
Two questions. What sort of power, what sort of special abilities is it that the characters have that are going to thrill the players? And what sort of missions do they go on? Terrorist ones, as you said, but what sort of deed do they do for the cause?
Things that start great stories. Because part of this is the whole, we've got to get the people believing that the empire that feeds them is actually not a good thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is, I mean, a lot of it is the classic mode of, well, Call of Cthulhu scenarios. You know, you investigate to find, you see there's a problem, you investigate to find out what's going on, and when you finish investigating, you have a fight.
Okay.
So some of this involves meeting things that are way weirder and more powerful than you are, because, you know, that's a good thing. There is definitely magic going on. There is find the specific magical thing that is causing the problem and deal with it, possibly by fighting it, possibly by talking to it. That kind of thing. But also, you know, beat up the corporate security guys who are gearing up for a raid on your friends. Yeah.
So the hub, the evil empire, is showing the world to be less weird than it actually is.
Yeah.
And you're bursting into the reality of the mundane male persons and saying, here, look at this. Which reminds me of...
At least to some extent, yeah.
Okay, well, this sounds interesting, and if you do actually run it, maybe I shall condescend to do my female character, if I have one. It's hidden somewhere inside me. And this is running on the Bundle of Holding until?
9th of April.
Okay.
Also, maybe not for everybody, but I rather like the art here. I don't usually notice game art, but this is... Well, I mean, for a start, it's largely depicting female characters, and it's not cheesecakey, which is frankly not a high standard, but it's a standard that all too many products don't reach. And I rather like it. So, take a look, see what you think.
Yes, the idea of the being a corporate drone and somebody bursting into your world and saying, here, look at this, there are demons in the sky, and being right is somehow pleasing.
Also, there are demons in the boardroom, quite possibly.
Yes, your bosses are all demons, especially human resources. But then, we've all suspected that, haven't we, dear listeners? This is going to be a discussion about designing game systems, and specifically using magic, the game systems which depict magic and strange stuff, as a core paradigm, which sprang out of a discussion on that excellent podcast, Grognard Files, between Dirk the Dice and Judge Blivey, about the nature of magic systems and what's good and what's irritating about them and what different people want out of magic systems and how much you can reconcile those. And the basic message that around which they built their discussions was sparked by something on their Discord. One of their subscribers there, Air Kane, by pseudonym, made a simple thesis that there were two types of magic, slow and fast. Fast is for combat or action, and is essentially buffs and debuffs. Slow is for summoning, rituals, cursing, etc. And when I stopped and thought about it, this is strikingly true of all the magic systems that are out there. And it's striking, most of all, that it's not about the magic itself. It's about the needs of the game. I think that's right in saying.
Well, I'd like to start there, possibly expanding our brief without a sensible limit, in that a magic system is a thing which... All right, I know people who technically argue with this, but let's leave them aside. Some of them are me, which is not reality checkable.
Yeah. In fact, for magic system, we're going to go on and talk about all the things that are creations of fancy, of storytelling, and are not reality checkable.
By which I don't just mean... You can't go out and, you know, shoot arrows at a target in the garden or whatever. It is certainly possible to say in this game, I want combat to work like combat in that action film, where, you know, you get hit once, it's just a flesh wound. you get hit a bunch of times. If you're a major character, you always have time for your dying words, that kind of thing. That is
feng shui for a
object. Yeah, or many other games in its wake. But that is still something where you can say, okay, does it work like the source material, or does it not? And magic systems, and to a large extent, technology later than the present day systems, generally can't do that. Unless you're actually running this specific fantasy setting or Star Trek or whatever, it is generally expected that your version of the weirdness will be distinctive, and indeed, to a large extent, it's often why the players have come here.
Yeah. Well, hang on. The boast of GURPS, and we do like GURPS around here, was that at the core it was realistic. And the core was...
Be very careful how you phrase that, because that's a thing that they've explicitly backed away from in the face of the sort of person who wants to use the vehicle design system to build a bicycle and then complain when it's not exactly the right weight, same weight as the bicycle he just bought.
I was going to come to GURPS vehicles later, because it is such a strange paradigm of this split that we're talking about.
But even on the basic level, a GURPS melee weapon does a little bit less damage than a GURPS pistol. This is not realistic.
True.
What I think has been said for 4th edition, at least, was that they were aiming for a baseline of heroic realism. In other words, the sort of thing you would see in a film, perhaps not necessarily a full-on pull or stops-out film. There is the cinematic mode on top of that, or you can go to a harsh realistic mode from baseline GURPS. But it's people are a bit better and tougher than they are in real life, and they're as good as they think they are.
Yeah, well, there's a reason that overconfidence is a disadvantage in GURPS.
And some of it's a disadvantage.
Some of it has to do with the effects of fast-moving bits of lead on near mortal flesh. What I'm going to say is that but there's a difference in type, not just in degree, here, or between GURPS, where a sword is about so long and it weighs about so much, and if you looked at a GURPS sword,
In the very early days, they actually did
world. You can say, yes, that's a broadsword, and here's the model of it in GURPS. And that's very unlike the weapons of the Exalted in the game of that name, which sometimes look just like the weird, too long to be real weapons in anime and Japanese high fantasy.
The one that always throws me is the sword that is just 6 inches from edge to edge.
Hmm.
That is quite a common anime and manga trope. And no.
Oh, but it looks good and it feels good. And it may be consistent inside the game world, but it's not in any sense realistic.
Sure.
But what I was going to try to say was, GURPS took combat, and if it moved away into heroic combat, it started from a mundane model. And you could say sensibly, if you want to check our figures, then do it against reality, which they did in early editions. But then they moved into the realm of fantasy, and they produced, as their first product, GURPS Fantasy, which contained the magic system, which is still the most popular and most used magic system in GURPS, I would say.
If only by virtue of being present in a basic form in the basic set of 3rd and 4th edition GURPS.
And being ready. That was the point of it. This is fast. All of GURPS magic, even the stuff which takes time, is prepackaged fast magic. It's the best job of creating a magic system without the core theory of magic that I've come across, but it's still done by guess and by God and spitball and string, by artistic decision and what works for the game and for the for the story.
Well, I'd actually argue that a magic system, and to a lesser, potentially lesser extent, a tech system, are probably the closest you're going to get to the designer's vision of what the game should be about, what it should be like, because there is no constraint of, yes, but I can actually lift a sword with one hand, but not all day. That's not that kind of thing.
It's true. Well, it's true, but it is... I'm not sure they knew going in precisely what sort of world they wanted to depict. In fact, I'm damn sure of it, because...
I think it's supposed to be usable anywhere.
Yeah, ain't no such thing. I don't think
so. Yes, it always strikes me as starting with an essentially Dungeon Bash-focused sort of magic. It's immediate, it's tactical, you can do a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. But then it puts onto that a lot of stuff which only has social storytelling implications, not necessarily combat-orientated implications. Stuff like the rules for healing, stuff like the rules for magical blessing of fields. I mean, magical blessings, generally. And
I remember a discussion in which somebody said, why doesn't GURPS magic have a contraception spell? And the answer was, it does. It's called Strike Baron.
Yeah. And the mages will charge you a considerable amount for reversing that implication upon you. All the market will bear, usually. I think that was a pun. It was very subconscious. The point I'm making is that this was a system that was set up without previously determined story world limits put upon it. And that is against everything that came later in the development of magic system.
I don't think there is an underlying theory of magic when you applied to GURPS spell magic.
No, I don't think there is.
You've got this basic idea that there is power which you can get in various ways, and you can use it for casting spells, and that's really about it.
Yeah, and Thaumatology, GURPS Thaumatology, does a good job of looking at some of the implications if you change that a bit. The nature of gathering power, the risks in gathering power, the chance to, I don't know, tie other people to altars and rip their hearts out for power is something that gets talked about. But game systems like After Hours Magica tend to have a set of rules put into before you get to the play, let's play with it and see what happens. They get a set of rules about these are the things this sort of magic can and can't do. These are the implications of the magic. And they start from there and they build up. It still produces some stuff that is probably not what the rules makers, the initial creators of the spell bashing system intended. But it rules in and rules out some specific things. And that is not a thing you can do with GURPS magic. And with a lot of other, here is a list of spells that are known, and you can pick from these spells sort of games. I mean, I think Arms Law and Spell Law was like that before. That didn't have a...
Do you mean as in Rollmaster?
As in Rollmaster, yeah.
Not... Well, no. Spell Law is the magic system for Rollmaster. It was... Yeah, one of the reasons this is slightly tricky is that Arms Law and Spell Law were originally published as add-on books that you could combine with your existing game of something else, to say, here is this magic system and here is this combat system. It was only a few years later that they came along and said, okay, here is this thing called Rollmaster, which incorporates these books and some linking material. So, okay, Rollmaster, Spell Law, there are three realms of power, Essence, which is your basic flow of the universe stuff. Channeling, which is somebody bigger gives you power. And mentalism, which is the power of your mind. Each of these works the same way. You know, you have a stat that's high enough, you get so many power points. It's obviously implied for channeling that you are worshipping something and keeping the rules and so on, but that's not baked into the game. There are core lists, which are, I think it was open and closed lists. Basically, there are lists that anybody in a realm using a realm can learn. Mm-hmm. Though some of them are much harder unless you're a specialist magician. You can have your fighter magician hybrid who learns the basic stuff, but a dedicated magician will learn the closed lists as well. And then each class has its own lists of this class's gimmick.
Yeah.
But that's about the extent of the underlying theory.
Well, that's compared with something like GURPS Magic, compared to like something like early versions of D&D, that's extremely detailed, and lots of decisions about how the universe really works have been made before any players or GMs get their hands on it.
It's very noticeable in that early GURPS Magic that there is no distinction between types of spellcaster. If you want to be a cleric with healing spells, you buy the healing spells rather than the blasting people spells. But there is nothing mechanically in the rules that says you can only buy healing spells. Well, we'll come back a bit to that later.
Yeah. But do you think that there is a coherent set of decisions behind that set, those limitations, those ways to do being a magician? Do you think there's a coherent set of decisions behind that, or do you think this is just a list of abilities we think would be cool and consistent, and they don't really cross over into each other?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I'm sure on the one level somebody said, we need three pure spellcaster classes for mentalism. What are we going to make them do? And tried to bodge things that would work as one thing Rollmaster has is the lay healer class, which is essentially much closer to being a medic.
Yeah.
And they have spells for things like prosthetic limbs.
But that
is a mentalist class.
Yeah.
Not a channeling class, which is where your normal healers happen.
Because, yeah, I remember back in the late 1970s trying to take the different types of spell user in AD&D seriously as a set of ways magic could be, and failing pretty strongly. Nowadays, I sort of get stuck on the three or four types of magical practitioners in RuneQuest, which are spirits and gods, sorcerers and mystics, which are two types of people who depend on slightly different classes of other beings to do their to get their power and the structure of their magic from, and two different classes of people who are going it off their own little bat and are using their own personal power to do things.
Hmm.
And I think that's still useful as an emotional fantasy. I find the sorcerer who does it for himself, who learns stuff and who has power because he's disciplined himself and trained himself, to be much more satisfying as a fantasy insert into a game world than the people who rely on other people. But I find priests who are doing things to please their gods a lot easier to model.
Yeah, one of the tricks, I suspect, is that there was a very long gap. I mean, basically the entire lifespan of AD&D, at least, between there are clerics who are clearly inspired in part by you know, Odo of Bayeux and another plate armored thugs with a cross on around their neck, but they have healing spells and so on. And much later came the idea that, okay, you are a cleric of a specific god, and they give you more of this sort of spell and less of that sort of spell, because that's what they do.
I note that St. Cuthbert and other such individuals are mentioned fairly early on.
As I understand it, basically all the names of people you meet in that early D&D stuff, like Tenser as of Tenser's floating disc, are PCs in one of the original campaigns.
Yeah. And the same sort of very early fan service can be found in the Rampa as well. Ducks, I say to you, ducks.
But one thing we were talking about before we got to the recording was schools of magic and specialist wizards.
Hmm.
And I've been tracing a bit of history on this because, your D&D, it's done by class. So original D&D, excluding the very original, but you basically have magic users and clerics.
Yeah.
And they work, their magic works the same way mechanically as in they have these spells. And when the spell is gone, it's gone.
You fill them with stuff you know.
But they have different and only very limited overlapping spell lists.
Yeah. I'm not sure if the only clerics can heal rule was there early on, or if it emerged out of later niche protection.
In the very early days, there weren't clerics in the fantasy supplement to Chainmail.
Hmm.
I think it was fighters and magic users first, and then clerics came in very early, and then thieves came in a bit later.
Yeah, clerics were certainly in place by the time I got involved, which was about Greyhawk time.
Yeah,
by Greyhawk we had paladins, which is a whole other story.
Yeah, so when you get to AD&D, you get subclass, what they call subclasses.
Hmm.
Specifically, what I'm thinking of here is the Druid and the Illusionist.
Yeah.
And in each case, they are like the overall class in the Cleric, the Magic User, but they have different spells, most crucially.
Hmm.
And they're, some of their numbers are tweaked as well. But basically, this is, I think, the first case of the specialist mage.
Yeah.
It's quite a crude thing. I mean, you are a magic user, or you are an illusionist. You can't learn some spells from the other one. Once you're committed, that's it. You could even multi-class, but that's desperately inefficient.
Yeah, and then, and then you get something, you get a spell lore, and you get this profusion of classes of different highly specialized types of mages. And yes, there's still a core wizard class, but they're sort of puny, and the advantage is all with the specialists.
It makes the overlap explicit. So rather than saying the basic class is the cleric and then you can have the druid, you say the cleric and the druid and the pure healer and somebody else I can't remember are now all channeling spell users with different lists. And obviously, because it's Rollmaster, different skill costs for every single skill in the game. But the linearity was quite set. If you could be a non-spell user, your fighter, your thief, stuff like that, or a semi-spell user, which is your paladin and things of that sort, or a pure spell user. I think there was another grade in between. Every realm of magic had this distinction.
Yeah, but you still get the feeling of it's still because never saw a new character class they didn't like. It's all bodged up and let's throw another thing into the mix and not worry about basic theory. And then you hit Ars Magica.
Not quite.
Well, all right.
There is one thing first, which I think is... I don't know if this is the first case of it, but it's the earliest one I've found, and I always like to talk about it anyway. So this is in Dragon Warriors, not the basic wizard class, which is very much the same sort of thing we've been talking about, but the Elementalist, which came out in book 5 of 6 of the original paperback. So this is 1986.
Okay.
And as an Elementalist, ignoring the Dark Elementalist, which is basically meant as an NPC class, you choose one of the 4 Platonic Elements as the thing you do, and you get a number of magic points for use on spells of that element. I think it's 3 times level. And then in each of the 2 non-opposed ones, so if you specialise in fire, then earth and air are in the middle and water would be opposed. You get 1 times your level in magic points. So you specialise in fire, you do a lot of fire, you do a bit of earth and air, and you can't do water at all. And similarly with any other element you choose. Yeah, if you're a darkness, then you specialise in darkness and everything else, and you choose 2 secondary, but that's... The darkness elementalists are really not intended, I think, for player characters. They have special variations, like, you know, the fire elementalist has a spell that will burn a building. When the darkness elementalist casts it, all the doors and windows lock.
Okay.
But anyway, what I'm getting at, I think, is that this is the first example I have come across of a game system which says you not just you are an X or you are a Y, but you specialise in X, but you can also get stuff from Y, just not as well as the specialist in Y.
I can see a straight line from that to the magic in Harnmaster, in Harnmaster Shekpavar, which was 1990, which had a sixfold range of circle of magical types, each of which has 2 neighbours which are slightly related to it, and 3 opposite, 1 directly opposite and 2 slightly opposite to them, which were more difficult to access. But you could, in theory, with a lot of dedication, work up your magic user to be an expert in all of them, and then become a grey mage, which was the model of the great super mages, who exist beyond the mere mortal levels of player characters.
Though presumably your typical mage you meet while you're out being an adventurer is going to be specialised in one of these.
He's likely to be, but even a master level mage is likely to be pretty damn specialised in one of the 6 kinds. And this wasn't all the kinds of possible magic. It deliberately did not set out to be that. But it gave a good variety of it. You've got light and air, fire and heat. You've got earth, plants and growing things. You've got magic of the mind. You have magic of water and darkness. You have the magic of the forge and the metals. And then you're back again to the magic of air. And all of them sit in a circle and do different things. But you can create... And the interesting thing about this, it's the second instance I've come across of it, is that there is no fixed spell book. There are examples of the commonly accepted spells for each of the 6 types and the grey magic. But there is no fixed spell book, and each individual player character is expected to create their own magic out of their own own convocation of magic, the type of magic that they know, and write that down and work with the GM, and both of them would have to work fairly hard to create magic that will work with the rest of the magic system to do strange things.
Yeah, this is a problem, of course, because... Okay, in the late 80s, possibly he could assume that players would have more and GMs would have more time to do this kind of thing. That is not generally an assumption you can make in a game design now. But the idea that you'll spend a lot of non-game time working out, even at the very least, you know, I want a spell that will do X much damage. How much power does that cost me to cast it? You know, how does that affect? What's its range like?
Yeah.
What's its casting time like? You know, these are all questions that a spell design system has to answer. There is no spell design system for GURPS. There has never been. There probably never will be because...
Hang on. I have to disagree. There's no spell design system for GURPS magic.
Yes, sorry. I'm talking about core GURPS magic here. Because so much of it was made up by what seemed reasonable to the original authors... It's simply not going to fit. I mean, there is a slowly progressing series of books converting each of those spells to GURPS power builds. I salute the people who are doing this work. I would say thankless, but they are getting paid for it. So,
yeah.
But one could argue that really this ought to have been part of GURPS 4th edition rather than carrying over the old spell system and all its.
There was too much. It is too valuable to throw away.
Yeah, yeah.
It is. They've done their best to create alternatives, and are still doing so. And I don't object to that. But this is the difference between fast and slow, and it's the core difference I wanted to come back to. Fast is for people who want their magic now and to have something they can create by looking up some things in the books. It's a longer process to create a GURPS wizard, but you can do it with templates, and you can do it fairly quickly. And even if you don't know exactly what each individual spell does, and that's what the fast player wants. There are slow players and there are fast players, as well as slow and fast systems, and I think it's vitally important to have the systems that serve slow players. The players who want to take their time and want to create something that fits their idea of how things should work and wants to explore the things that other players don't give a good goddamn about. And this expands both to magic. Magic is the paradigm for this because... magic, if it existed, would be an intensely personal thing. But for everything that a player is obsessed with, there is value in a slow system that allows you to go through and justify everything that happens. You remember, because I remember, the GURPS Traveller game, in which you were playing the person who did the economic calculations and the merchanting for the entire crew. You were the only person interested. I was interested in what story beats that could give me, but I wasn't that interested in running it. And you took it from me and said, here's what I think should happen here.
Also, I automated a whole bunch of it where it was simply do this, die roll, and order the result.
That's very sensible.
But this comes back to something I won't talk about at length here because I've mentioned it several times before, the idea that particularly in 80s and early 90s game designs, but what I think of as the first era of role-playing as it got out into the public space. Mm-hmm. Though, yeah, we did not have the internet to argue on. For most people, there would be large periods of time where they wanted to think about game-type things and do game-type things, but did not have other players available. Did not have other role players available to talk to about them, and that is where I think. Well, I mean, also in games like Car Wars or BattleTech, where designing your own units is a big part of the game, I would argue, especially Car Wars, where you could probably win or lose purely on the design spreadsheet, never mind actually doing the fight. But the Traveller trade system, the Ars Magicas, well, we'll come back to Ars Magica because you know more about it than I do. Yeah. But there are a lot of these things which are either for a spaceship design, therefore either for a player to do on their own or for a GM to do on their own, or maybe two of them talking together about it, but they are absolutely not a thing you would do at the table.
Blue booking. So writing out.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what communication there was via what do we call
bulletin boards?
American Press Associations.
That too, yeah.
There
were some bulletin boards, but I didn't have a modem in those days. So
yeah, it was a great revelation when they began to be common things that you could have in your own home. But you've got, with that result, you've got a lot of game systems which were the result of one person's work or one small group of persons' work, and there's some of them which have survived and some of which died a probably honourable and probably necessary death over the years and left some things behind. And at the end of that era and at the start of the 21st century, there were things like GURPS vehicles. Oh my goodness. Can I rant about GURPS vehicles a little bit?
All right.
It comes basically down to why, for God's sake. Why?
I have used it. I have liked it. I should say there is, this has been officially announced, there is not going to be a GURPS vehicles for 4th edition.
Oh, well.
And part of that is simply the people who come on the forums and say, this universal system does not give me a perfectly accurate result for this specific case. GURPS is terrible.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, if they're not grateful, you shouldn't give it to them. But hang on, it seems to be attempting to take the laws of physics and gamify them.
Yes.
But this is probably fine when you get into fantasy physics, when you get into starships and flying carpets and what have you, that's probably fine because you can round out the laws of physics as they apply to the super tech and the high magic, and that will work. But you start with a bicycle, and they start with bicycles and rowboats and wheelbarrows and work up from there, and that has to be rooted. And descriptive physics ought to stem from the things that exist in the world, not the things that exist on paper.
Yeah, and that's why it's complex, because it has to account for various sorts of, for example, internal combustion engine.
Yeah.
If I'm running a game set in the real world, then I will just look up real world stats for the vehicles. Fair enough. There are enough stupidly fast sports cars that I don't need to worry about. But if I am running one, the main thing I used it for, I still have a bunch of the vehicle designs from this, was a Traveller style campaign.
Hmm.
And one of the things that fell out of that and flavoured the campaign is modes of operation are not free. So you can build your spaceship that will take off from a starport on a planet, fly out to the jump point, jump, fly back in, land, and so on. You can do all those things. If you say, all right, but it can't land vertically, it needs a runway to take off and land, you can get a whole lot more cargo space.
Hmm.
If you say, all right, we don't need to carry the in-system drive engines in the hyperdrive ship, and we don't need to carry the hyperdrive engines in the in-system drive ship, again, you can get a lot more cargo space. And what that fell out in terms of campaign design was the space for the free trader is not competing with the big boys on the established routes, which are, you know, between places that have space stations and infrastructure, so you can have just the jump ship or whatever. It is going to the place that has one runway and they need to herd the goats off it before you land. Or maybe that doesn't have a runway at all. And so, you know, it has enough gravity but a thin atmosphere, which you can get in quite rare planetary situations, that you can't actually aerobrake, so you need to do a vertical landing. That kind of thing. So, you know, planets that are, yeah, maybe there's something interesting enough that they got settled, but they're not big enough, they're not productive enough to get the attention from, you know, the big ships simply can't go there. And that's where you get your tramp freighter.
And this is why I say the slow systems matter. That the detailed system, how much of that is derived from the real world physics and how much from the fantasy physics? But
well, I don't think there's a hard dividing line. And you can say that this space drive produces more thrust for less fuel than a real world space drive. But that's just a number. It's still a space drive that consumes fuel and produces thrust.
Hmm.
And if the numbers are right for the real ones, then you can say, okay, we'll put this up a bit for the fantasy one, put it up a bit for the bit more for the next tech level. Yeah. So,
right. Well, so at least then you know when you're breaking the real world details, and you know when the real world details come back if the magic tech stops working. And I think this is why, what I'm trying to say, I suppose, is that though I'm the sort of person that regards an internal combustion engine as a black box that sometimes stops working, and I'm terribly sorry, there, touch, pat, I have to say the same thing to my faithful desktop computer. But nonetheless, I want the people who give a good goddamn to be able to have systems which contribute to their sense of being involved in the general fantasy. And as a person who cares about the idea of magic, I want there to be a magic system which allows me, if I want to engineer the magic, to put together the things that my prejudice is about magic imply. Let's go back to Ars Magica to round this up. Ars Magica starts, reportedly, with Jonathan Tweet and his comrades, Mark Nine Haining, saying, wizards in D&D are nerfed. Can we create a magic system where wizards aren't nerfed, which is still interesting? I mean, everybody gets an infinite amount of wishes isn't interesting. But can we find a system which allows the wizards to be truly mighty and yet provides them decisions that have to be made? And this mixture of social limitations and game world limitations, which Ars Magica comes up with, is the result. And I think ever since, magical systems have relied on that twin set of restrictions. There are things the game world will counter your magic with, and there are things you just can't do with the magic. And I think that is a really very interesting, and it's still very fruitful, set of things to explore.
Yeah, it's something that a generic system can't do, except insofar as it says this magic system is designed for this world where there are these social restrictions.
Hmm. Well, social restrictions you can build into anything, but I'm going to my Ars Magica files. Anything where people are willing to admit that they have social obligations. Murder hippos.
One of the nice things about Ars Magica is, you know, if your crops are failing and a wizard shows up, your reaction is probably going to be, oh crap, you know, maybe we will get a good crop, Maybe we will get a good crop of talking frogs.
Well, yeah, if the magician turns up and says he is a saint and can bullshit you into believing that they are... hang on. There are two chapters I'm trying to look at simultaneously, which isn't easy. Theory and magic.
Let's go to that. Got two eyeballs, haven't you?
I got two screens for that matter. okay, hang on. Let me go to 5th edition abilities. Oh, good grief. There's so much of this stuff. Okay. Limits of magic. This is what I was talking about. This is the stuff they baked in early, and I'm not sure if I were doing it this way, I would do it. But part of this is set there to make the world not change too much. And part of it is showing up that they know things about medieval Aristotelian philosophy. There's the limit of aging, which says there's a limit to what you can do. You can never reverse aging, though you can slow it down a bit. That has prices too. There's the limit of arcane connections, which means you need a true name or a piece of the person's skin or hair to target somebody you can't see. There's a limit of creation, which says you can't create anything new without using up raw concentrated magic, which is a valued resource. You can't restore physical energy. It can't restore mental confidence. You can't make...
Sorry, I see a lot of perpetual motion machines that it turns out that game systems will support with only minor tweaking behind that one of those rules.
Yeah. There's the limit of the infernal. You can't make demons do truth. They will lie even if they are telling you the bare truth. They are deceivers, and you can't tell with your magic if what in front of you is a demon. You need specialist stuff for that. And here's the Aristotelian thing: you can't influence anything beyond the lunar sphere. You can't create an immortal soul. You can destroy one with magic. You can't alter the passage of time, which is bent by some of the effects in the world. You can't alter true love or true friendship with magic. It means anything you can alter isn't true. You can't change the art, the nature, the art of which raw magic is dedicated to. And to limit everything, there's a thing called warping, which happens to magicians of all schools, not just the hermetic ones, who are exposed to magic for long periods of time. They accumulate warping points, and the magic starts changing them in various stages over time, and you can't undo the warping. And those are just the lesser limits. There's also the fact you can't affect the divine, the power of God at all, and you can't change a thing's essential nature, which I'm not sure is entirely true.
I think some of those are kind of implied as the general case of some of the specific rules, but...
Yeah,
I'm just picturing, ha ha ha, I slept with your girlfriend, but we're in love. Guess you're not.
No, it's perfectly all right for you to... Well, yes, I don't know if I don't know if in the paradigm of... Actually, you can have true love in the medieval paradigm for somebody else's wife, so that can't be true. The courtly love is true love for somebody else's wife, and I think that's probably something that's going to be accepted by the world. And that sort of makes the limit of the divine and the limit of true nature fight with each other. Now I come to think about it, but something like that, a list of things that the magic, the super science, whatever it is, can't do right at the start is very useful. It's very limiting, And I got the feeling that a lot of modern Ars Magica is devoted to exclusion, to exceptions and exclusions on that set of assumptions. And there is the fact that all of that applies only to one school of magic, even if it is the biggest. And that's really interesting to me. But I could bore most of my players to death talking about this.
Yeah, though this is very much a thing that I look for in magic systems and tech systems. The idea that there is a fundamental principle that is taken into account during the design of it. Because, okay, this comes into my very small contribution to literary criticism, which I'm sure has been done elsewhere, but I haven't come across it laid out before, which I tend to refer to as the maker versus user distinction. In other words, does this system give you a standard set of spells, each of which does a standard thing, like your D&D? Or does it give you a toolbox that you can assemble into things that were not predicted by the inventor of the spell system? I mean, most obviously, like in there would be your mage magic, though I think Ars Magica shares a fair bit with this, as in, my understanding of fire is so profound that I can do a fire-related thing without having specifically planned it or learned that particular spell. Yeah, I can just come up with that because I know how fire works. I know how fire is.
Okay, actually, that's a distinction. That's a distinction between fast slow magic and slow magic. Okay, what I mean is that there are some systems, and it's not all systems, which allow you to improvise around the core idea of your magic. You'll find it in Ars Magica. You'll find it in Unknown Armies. And you'll find it in several places, but it's not everywhere. It's not in Hard Magic, though I wish it was. But then there's the let's sit down with lots of paper and lots of books and spend several months getting this stable, which will be easier to use in the end. But I can't just pull out of my hat now that I'm faced with a dragon. I need to fireproof myself in a hurry.
As I understand it, both Ars Magica and Mage, as well as having this thing, have the idea of here are some standard things that you can simply learn to do, and you don't have to invent on the spot.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Greg Stolze's Reign has both a set of explicit rules and a lot of worked examples, and he goes for in Helondo and whatever his name is. In the core setting, he goes in for schools of magic where most people are going to want to attune themselves to a particular kind of magic so that they can use it very quick and very easily without having to do rituals to get into the space of that magic. And a few people are going to study lots of different kinds of magic and say, hey, I can do this sort of magic and that sort of magic and 63 other kinds of magic, but I can't do them as fast as the specialists can. And that's interesting too.
Though, I do want to come back to the maker versus user thing, because players are, or tend to be in my experience, makers. Even in a system like GURPS Magic, which is very much here is a bunch of spells which do a single thing, players will say, I want to combine these spells to do an unexpected thing. In a book, you can simply say, oh, well, I guess the characters didn't think of that. In a game, you can't.
Yeah.
So that is why if it's not already there in the game, I pretty much have to invent an overarching principle, because when the player says, I want to do thing X with this magic, this technology, I need to be able to answer that. How difficult is it going to be? Is it actually impossible? Do you know it's impossible?
Yeah.
I think of this very much as a concept of science fiction stories more than fantasy stories, because a lot of fantasy stories are you get what you get, and you know, the golden age was in the old days and we can't go back there. There are, of course, exceptions. But generally, I find in most games, players come in more to what I think of as the science fictional thinking. Yeah. Let us build a new thing. Let us build a better thing.
Yeah, there are implied rules, I would say, and I don't ask me for them at the moment. In the two magic systems I know best, which would be GURPS magic and the spirit stroke divine magic in RuneQuest, there are things you can imply as being rules in the combination of various sets of things, but they're not there out there openly, and sometimes I think they get subsumed into the players, into the long-term players' memories. I would like to say, yes, role players tend to be makers, but not all role players are makers interested in making everything.
Sure.
And that can be a problem. And the problem of a hyper-specialized role-playing system with things like Ars Magica is definitely one which makes Ars Magica groups specialized in character and sometimes a bit imbalanced for that reason.
I have occasionally overheard Ars Magica LARPs, and the bits I overheard were much more about arcane philosophy and politics than they were about magic, insofar as there's a distinction.
True, but if you run a LARP, you're going to have issued to the players little slips of paper with these other spells you know well enough to do well and quickly. I have tried to get 12 or 13 people into a magic circle in a Ars Magica LARP, trying to persuade them to do something consistent with each of their individual styles of magic to summon something, I think it was. And at least one person didn't want to be doing that. It was complicated. I will say that there are game systems where, and they are probably quite unplayable for most players, things like sufficiently advanced and sufficiently sorcerous, I think it's magical equivalent, that is, which are about the time when you've reached past the, what it was called, the discontinuity, the rapture of the nerds, and all sorts of things are possible, and you're talking about the sort of politics and moral decision which comes with people have effectively infinite power over particular areas. And it's interesting as an idea. Singularity, that was the word I was trying to get to. But that it's interesting as an exercise, but I'm not sure it's playable as a game.
Well, by definition, the beings in existence after such a point are not recognisably human. I mean, that's what defines it.
Oh, and that's true. And
if you recognise them as humans, it wasn't really a singularity.
I think the interesting point is having things that remember having been human and haven't quite reconciled themselves to picking up on the thing they shared with all these other entities around here. You know, I think that's the interesting point to talk about. I'm not sure I wanted to become divine just yet, personally speaking. But let me. I reserve the right to reconsider that decision.
I just want to drop in a side note. I have a friend who generally just doesn't like playing wizards, however defined, because his approach is more or less ordinary people going into extraordinary situations. He's a big fan of Call of Cthulhu, for example.
Yeah.
In an action film, he would be John McClane in Die Hard, the ordinary guy who is thrown into the situation and...
Yeah.
Yes, he has skills and so on, but he survives through grit and determination and quick thinking rather than through having a superpower.
Yeah, I can understand why, except...
So this would make, for example, a mage game quite difficult to play.
Yeah, I think I was going to say about mage, but I can't remember what it was. I would say, in conclusion, I think this is a paradigm which applies to most of the stuff in role-playing games, which is bespoke versus off-the-shelf. And having the system that creates the bespoke there from the beginning and thought about from the beginning of the system, or as soon as after as you become aware that it's a problem, so that you can justify the things you put into the hands of the players as off-the-shelf stuff. Your warrior wants an off-the-shelf sword, but no, it can't be that light. And it can't cut that fine. And
aluminium is what that sword is.
you can't have the super swooshy sword. You know why Vorpal blades are called Vorpal blades? I worked this out the other day.
They go snicker snack. That's where the word comes from.
They go warp, warp. At least they do in my games. Oh, yeah, that's what that means. I came across that illumination whilst playing Munchkin. They'd be glad to hear.
Well, okay. You could always do the Chronicles of War game where the tip of the sword is basically a black hole.
Hmm. Yeah, be very careful when sheathing it, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I think that's the true thing I wanted to say, that it's you want the bespoke things, and you want the system behind the bespoke things, but most people are going to want off the shelf.
It needs to work if you don't want to engage with the system, but the system should be there for the people who do, and just to make the thing a bit more consistent.
All right, let's stop there. If you have a list of things you really wish your role-playing games had more mechanics for that you could go off and gloat over for a while, then do please tell us about them. We'd be interested. And cases in which you've discovered this difference of interest between your different classes of players. You can reach us by...
Leave a message on the website or email podcast@tekeli.ly.
And we will go into different aspects of Aristotelian philosophy next time. We hope you'll be able to join.
No promises.